wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, where the time is now 9:03, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge, along with our engineer, Patsy Kullberg, bringing you an hour of news and commentary from the Old Mole's radical perspective, rooting down the mountains of capitalism and giving voice to those who aim to build a better world, organized for the benefit of all of us, indeed of all living creatures and the living planet that supports us. On today's show, we'll be hearing a conversation with Brian Wilson, a longtime Portland peace activist around Central American issues, who is now living in Nicaragua and working to establish a peace center there. The Old Mole's Todd Sloan went to visit him, and we'll hear their conversation about Brian's life and work. Then Denise Morris will discuss why shooting victim Republican Congressman Steve Scalise was invited by the Washington National Baseball Team to throw out the first pitch at their playoff game. And I will have a commentary about how the conditions of life dictated by capitalism make us crazy. And to start off the show today, Bill Resnick is here to talk with housing activist Margot Black about Portland's housing crisis. Although, first let me tell you that today's show, like all our shows, can be heard again at the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Today's show should be up in a day or two. You can listen or recommend to your friends either the whole show or individual pieces. Now, here's Bill Resnick with Margot Black to talk about housing. Bill.
Hi, Margot Black. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Margot Black teaches math at Lewis and Clark College. She's a dedicated activist, co-founded the organization Portland Tenants United. It grew rapidly, attracting people and support from all over the city. In fact, becoming a force in the city, challenging abusive landlords and picketing them, embarrassing them, forcing them to act within the law, also changing the laws. And in fact, getting action from the city, actions that landlords strongly oppose. Margot, tell us about Tenants United, why it got organized, its successes, its recent hearing before the city council, and then we'll begin discussing the housing crisis in general and a lot that has to be done. First, though, tell us about Tenants United.
Sure. We started Portland Tenants United in the summer of 2015, and that was after about a year of growing conversations, really in various venues on social media and sort of starting to trickle out into the real world where, you know, due to the recession in 2008 and a mass exodus from homeownership into rentership combined with Portland's population growing, combined with the building stopping, there were more renters than there were houses, and the rents just started shooting up. You started seeing building-wide no-cause evictions. People were being forced out of their homes and then realizing that, you know, their security deposits were being stolen. And really, it was just kind of this growing chorus of folks who felt really powerless. You know, were told to just move if they didn't like it or find a city they could afford when they, you know, lived here their whole lives and helped make Portland what it was.
And a whole lot of homelessness.
And then the homelessness was just burgeoning. And, you know, renters were feeling really alienated and isolated, really internalizing it, like it's their fault for having not bought a house or worked harder or tried harder. And we just started to talk about it and realize that we're not alone and it's not natural. It doesn't make any sense. We're paying more than a mortgage and we have zero security. And so we came together feeling like, you know, hearing from our policymakers that they either didn't think it was an issue or that their hands were tied, and realized this, you know, there was a lot of rage. So it could really use an infusion of direct action and unapologetic advocacy on a bunch of different planks because, you know, together we're stronger and we can leverage our power of rent and not pay it if enough of us come together and sort of the union model, the labor strike becomes the rent strike because they can't evict us all. So that's how the union started in 2015. As you said, it's grown fast.
And you've had a lot of success, although there's a lot, much, much more that has to be done. But first, tell us about the success and your recent struggles.
Yeah, so I mean, I think our biggest victory is really just raising awareness and shifting consciousness on this. We've made tenants' rights an issue. Affordable housing is something that has policymakers and wonks have talked about forever with, you know, varying degrees of success. But affordable housing means creating revenue streams to pay nonprofit developers or incentivize for-profit developers to, you know, build subsidized housing, which is great, but it's very different than the power imbalance between tenant and landlord that affects everybody who can't get into subsidized housing. So we've, you know,
it also doesn't build much. It doesn't build much housing either in comparison to the.
Right, and it challenges the entrenched power of land ownership. So nobody wanted to talk about it. So we've got people talking about that. We got the mayor talking about it when he was a candidate, and we worked with him to get him to put out a tenants' bill of rights. At the legislature, they actually had lifting the ban on local rent control got through the House and almost through the Senate. When you know the year before, I was told by lobbyists down in Salem that it'll be 20 years before anybody even says the word rent control out loud in Salem. And it took a year until we almost had it, or at least we almost had the ability to enact
it. Except for the betrayal of one Democratic representative, you would have had it.
Yeah, Senator Rod Monroe took $10,000 from the landlord lobby and said he wasn't going to vote on the bill. Senator Betsy Johnson, who's also a Democrat, also refused. We felt like Rod's treachery was much worse because he lives in like a pressure cooker of the next wave of gentrification out in East Portland. He's a landlord himself of over 50 units in a small apartment building, and we just his no vote was just unjustifiable. And not to give Betsy Johnson any latitude there at all, but she's in a more rural area where she probably hasn't, you know, she doesn't have a dense pocket of apartments, so. I think our biggest, you know, success, we've gotten landlords to pay attention to us. They've negotiated the non-negotiable leases as, you know, tenants have organized in their buildings. But we successfully unseated incumbent City Councilman Steve Novick and replaced him with tenants' rights champion Commissioner Udaly, Chloe Udaly. And barely a month after taking office, she passed Portland's historic relocation ordinance, relocation assistance, which says that if your landlord gives you a no-cause eviction or raises your rent by more than 10% in 1 year, and that is not a rent increase that you can afford, that you can absorb, in either of those cases, they have to pay your relocation costs or something towards that. So it goes from $2,900 for a studio to $4,500 for a three-bedroom or bigger. And so the landlord just has to write that check, and then you actually have money for the security deposit, for, you know, the double rent, for application fees, for packing and moving. It was a unanimous vote. It was effective immediately, and it was even retroactive to any notice in effect. It really shook the landlords to their core and said, all right, the game has changed and we actually have power and we're not going to go away. And the city felt that, the landlords felt that, and the state felt that, and that's been a real big deal.
You've got a movement going here. There are movements across the country. They've had some successes, but the housing crisis is going to continue and get worse. Unless some very basic things are done, why don't you talk about the housing crisis? How is it that so many people are now paying 50% of their income, or even more, and go hungry at the end of the month just to make the rent payment?
Well, you know, you're going to hear a lot about how we have a supply problem. You're going to hear a lot about how wages haven't kept up with rent, so we need higher wages. And I think all of that is smoke and mirrors. You know, we don't have a housing supply problem. We have an affordable housing supply problem. We have a housing used for homes supply problem. I mean, the fact of the matter is that housing.
You mean housing used for investment?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, housing used to be for people to live in and to build their community, to get to know their neighbors. You know, where I grew up, you know, most of the kids I went to school with were born and raised in those homes and then, you know, might inherit them from their parents. And we didn't see housing as a high return investment vehicle. And we really saw them as a place to make memories and create rituals and dig into the community. And even in rental housing, I mean, even there are plenty of certainly big cities, but you don't even have to be in a big city where people would live in their apartments for 20, 30 years. And sure, some people would come and go, but a lot of folks would stay and build community there. But where in the ownership model now, it has become a commodity. It's become a way to make money. It's no longer a place, you don't think about buying a house. Even if you are going to move into the house, you may think about the school district and the parks and libraries, but really what you're thinking about is, when I sell this in 5 years, how much money am I going to make? I mean, I have an embarrassing amount of money in student loans. And I've been told by people, the way to pay off your student loans is to buy a house, borrow against the equity. That should not be the way that we are paying for our kids' education. It should not be what we depend upon in order to retire. Retire in your home because you don't have a mortgage to pay anymore, sure. But your home and your rental properties as your retirement account, there's no reason why we need to be passing off the burden of our lack of a social safety net onto renters to now fund our landlords' kids' college education and fund our landlords' retirement account. I don't begrudge them for wanting to put their kids in college.
Yeah, and the big investment funds that are buying more and more and more property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, PERS
homes.
They're landlord.
Yeah, there's that. Well, yeah, and there are also some investment funds that have bought everything.
Yeah, after they foreclosed.
Very discounted after the foreclosures, who now own thousands of homes all over the country.
Yeah.
And charge as much as they can, foreclose, and then do more of it.
They have sophisticated computer models that say exactly what they can charge for rent, and they've figured out how to extract every possible fee and fine and pass every cost off onto the tenant. And these are the same people who created the foreclosure crisis, cleared everyone out of their homes, destroyed the global economy, then bought those homes back up and are renting them to us at twice what we should be paying, and calling it market value. Like, no one questions that. What is creating the market value when you are talking about something that should be a utility
and that everybody needs? This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Margo Black, who is one of the co-founders, still an activist, very active in Portland Tenants United. We were talking about the larger picture. There's a lot of things that can be done to protect tenants. But there are so many things that are vitally important to do that have to be done by the federal government and to some extent the states. For example, public housing. The rise of conservatism has meant that public housing has been cut enormously, and really very little is now being built, and some of it's being sold off, and some of them is just being destroyed. The land sold off to developers for luxury apartments, of course, that they then sell to investment funds,
which largely sit vacant
and stay vacant. There's many things, though, that can be done. One of them, of course, has to be a federal and state commitment to, in fact, extract some of the money from the rich, like a tax on luxury apartments, a tax on vacant high rises, on vacant land, to pay for just a wide variety of things.
Public housing
to clear horrible land vacant and build what now we can imagine is really wonderful public housing designs and environmentally sustainable designs. It seems to me that a big part of the housing crisis is it's not going to be solved until we, in fact, build that kind of national movement that changes the priorities of the country.
Yeah, and I mean, we really have to look at our values underlying that policy. Like, it has to come back to what kind of community do people want to live in, and not, like, how do we make the most money off of this land later? And I think when we ask the question and we design housing and make housing policy around people living and working and playing and praying in their community, then we have green space and we have walkable neighborhoods and we have housing that everybody can afford no matter where they are on the income spectrum. And once you know that you get to live there and create community and get to know your neighbors, then you do that and you start to care more about it and steward it better. And we can really shift the way that cities and suburbs and the culture there and really get to a healthier place in terms of sustainability, in terms of everything that makes a healthy community healthy. We have to build homes for people to live in and not to make money from.
Yeah, and reconstruct our cities.
Yeah.
And some cities have very different challenges than others. Portland has its challenges. Detroit, Cleveland, Milwaukee, lots of cities, and many now decaying inner suburbs, they have their problems. And in fact, there's a rehabilitation requirements, really investing in those cities and bringing jobs there.
Yeah.
People are flooding to Portland because it's been a good job market for
right.
one reason.
Right.
And then they pay huge rents and some of these single people can do that, especially if they triple up or more.
You know, you would be surprised how many people are living paycheck to paycheck, even in higher income brackets,
yeah,
because of the housing. And, nobody wants to feel sorry for somebody making $200,000 a year. But when you're paying $5,000 a month in rent, and then you're not getting your – and that's more Bay Area stuff, but you're not getting your mortgage interest deduction, which is our biggest housing subsidy – in the country.
And it goes to the rich.
And, you know, you even get a mortgage interest deduction for a second home. It is unconscionable that we are incentivizing people having two homes when so many people don't even have one.
Yeah, or multiple homes that they buy as investment vehicles
exactly,
and rent.
Yeah.
And,
the game is so rigged tax-wise for rental properties.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
All that has to change. Well, Margo, we've done it today.
Done it.
Tell, how do people get in touch with Tenants United?
Well, the best way to find us is our website, which really just goes to our Facebook page right now, but you can see it even if you don't have Facebook, and that's PDXTU, so T as in tenant, U as in United, pdxtu.org. You can also email us at info@pdxtu.org. Put December 6th on the calendar for when we go back to City Hall and demand a permanent relocation policy and close the single rental exemption that is leaving huge swaths of tenants unprotected without any justification.
Yeah, and another thing Tenants United does is protect tenants in a variety of ways. For those who need help, you can talk to Tenants United. Margo Black, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me on. Have a great morning.
You too.
Bye-bye.
And that's a song called The Unpredictable Landlord by Bedhead. In case you couldn't make out the lyrics, they go like this. No words more misused than absurd, but no words more absurd than misused. So fix this place. The ceiling's leaking from everywhere. Bricks and beams are falling from the sky, and no one deserves to live here. And before that, we heard Margo Black and Bill Resnick discussing the housing crisis here on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Coming up on The Old Mole, we'll be hearing about politicizing baseball and capitalism and mental illness. But first, Todd Sloan, currently on sabbatical in Central America, interviews peace activist Brian Wilson, who after many years in Portland, moved this past summer to Granada, Nicaragua, to establish Casa Sandino, a peace education center. Wilson's campaign against war began after witnessing routine atrocities in Vietnam in the late 60s. In 1987, protesting the shipment of U.S. weapons to Central America, he lost his legs below the knees when he and other veterans blocked a train at the Concord, California Naval Weapons Station. You can learn more about Wilson's life in his book, Blood on the Tracks, and the recent documentary about his peace work, Paying the Price for Peace. And look for his forthcoming book on the Vietnam War, Please Don't Thank Me for My Service. And now, here's Todd Sloan talking with Brian Wilson.
Hello, this is Todd Sloan for the Old Mole Variety Hour, sitting here in Granada, Nicaragua, with Brian Wilson, who many of you in the Portland activist community know for his long years of work for peace and for environmental and social justice. And I happen to be in Managua now myself for a while, and I decided to come and see what he's up to in Granada and let him find his own words to send a message back to Portland about what he's doing here, and pretty happy to see him in this beautiful country. So, Brian, tell us how you're doing and what you're hoping to do here in Nicaragua.
Well, I have purchased a house in Granada, which I'm now fixing up to be what I call Casa Sandino. It's going to be a solidarity house for people who want to visit Nicaragua and Granada specifically. It'll have a lot of information about the history of U.S. intervention in Nicaragua and history about the revolution. It'll have a community room where I hope to have a lot of events, a big dining room, a swimming pool, a couple of extra bedrooms. So that is being renovated right now and it won't be completed until late November. Temporarily, I'm living in a furnished house in Granada. But I'm a citizen now of Nicaragua. I did not give up my U.S. citizenship, but I am a citizen of Nicaragua as well. I'm 76, so this seems to be my last, perhaps my last chapter.
Many decades more.
Yeah. And so I'm trying to get integrated into Nicaragua the best I can. I have a lot of friends in Nicaragua from all the years that I have come here. I began coming here in 1986. During the Reagan war years. I'm a member of the ORD, which is the Organization of Revolutionary Disabled. I'm a full member of that group, and I attend their meetings, even though I always still have to have a translator to make sure I understand everything that's being said and that they understand what I'm saying. I am in the process of actually planning another book of interviews with ex-combatants during the war, probably both Contras and ex-Sandinistas, and I want to tentatively title the book Reagan's Vicious War 30 Years Later from the standpoint of the people I interview, who all of whom will have been injured mentally or physically from the war, and I'm getting to know them more and more. So I've already started that process of getting to know some of these ex-soldiers. And of course, for me, every injury that they have, I feel partially responsible for it because it was my country that went on this Reagan's madness campaign against any kind of liberation movement in Central America that he called communists and a Soviet beachhead. So I feel, in a way, responsible for these injuries, and I want people to, I don't want to forget what the U.S. did. I don't want the Nicaraguans to forget, which is not likely. But I also don't want the U.S. people to forget. So I'm hoping it'll be in Spanish and English, both. I've had some health issues I've had to resolve since I've been here, which has slowed me down. But I seem to be getting through all of them. I've had great care here in Nicaragua by the services here, including a surgery, including work on my prosthetic legs. Great doctor here. So I'm getting to know more about the healthcare system, the economy, people's sentiments about the government, about their history, about the U.S.
I'm getting the sense that much of your work over many years now in the other book you're about to publish is all about helping people remember things that we prefer to forget, like that there were wars and war, the Contra war against the Sandinista government and the Vietnam War and so forth. Can you comment on how important it is to remember and know the details about past conflict?
Well, part of my recovering from what I call the American way of life, which started in my Vietnam experience, was I realized I didn't know anything about history. And history is context. It's the context of the human evolutionary journey. And if you don't know the history and the context, then you're at the mercy of whatever somebody's saying in the moment without a critical capacity to critique it. So you become very easily a follower or a believer without critical thought. And so to me, history is indispensable for my understanding my own journey as a human being, coming from settlers that came over here 200 years ago. Knowing what humans, and especially my version, which is white Eurocentric Americans, or white Eurocentrics, what we have done, and the mythologies that we live on, that outsource all the pain and suffering so we don't have to feel it, but it's a consequent of incredible layers of pain and suffering that we've all called the American way of life or exceptionalism. And so I really like to zero in on the devil and the details of history. What has it really been about? And Nicaragua was a case study. I happened to start coming here in 1986, so I became very comfortable with the Nicaraguan people, even when I couldn't speak, even still can't speak the language very well. But knowing what my country has done to these people, we started intervening here in 1853. And it never seems to stop. And it affects people's psyches. Of course, it affects their economy. It affects their culture. It affects their education. And so I'm interested, essentially, for my own recovery purposes, of reestablishing a more authentic relationship to reality through other people's lives, through looking at what the Earth is doing. The Earth is correcting us now, I would suggest, and we may not survive it. Extinction may be the ultimate correction for our geological era on the planet. But in the meantime, I'm interested in relating to people around how to be respectful. And I want this Casa Sandino to be a place where people can discuss history, the history of what the U.S. has done to Nicaragua. It's just a case study, because you could go around the world and say what the United States has done to many countries. And also, the history of the revolution. The revolution in Nicaragua was extraordinarily exciting in the 80s, and I was here for much of it. And that kind of contagious, too, the sense that when people have, they discover their autonomy or their ability to articulate what they need, independent of what some outsider tells them they need. And looking at the murals that developed in Nicaragua from 79 to early 90s. It's incredible. The human spirit is manifested in those murals. And all those murals pretty much were eliminated after the Sandinistas lost in 1990. They were painted over, they were erased, because the new right-wing government didn't want people to be reminded of this people power that's expressed in art and music and politics and literacy and dignity. So part of what I do is my own recovery from having been so brainwashed in the American way. I thought it was great, as did a lot of us. And then to find out that it's exceptionally diabolical. And that doesn't mean humans are necessarily stuck with being diabolical, but in the collective participation in a society that's built on materialism and lies, we all get affected somehow, and it requires, I believe, a very conscious, awakened effort to recover from it. I'll be recovering forever.
So being outside of the country like this gives one a clearer perspective sometimes, that looking back and seeing a bit of the news and so forth, it's easier to come to that more clear perspective on what's going on, right?
Yes, and I also know that the United States still demonizes the current Nicaraguan government, Sandinistas, Daniel Ortega. They continue to demonize it. Of course, you could identify and examine almost any leader in the world, and you can find ways to demonize them, because power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But if you look at how Nicaragua relates to Honduras, El Salvador, Mexico, Guatemala, even Costa Rica or Panama, it's coming out pretty good. It's dramatically reduced poverty. It's dramatically increased literacy again. It has lots of renewable energy with a geothermal, because they have 23 volcanoes here in Nicaragua. But things are running fairly well, even though there's still lots of poverty here, lots of needs. They've improved the roads and the communication systems. All the parks have Wi-Fi now. So there's a lot of things about Nicaragua that's pretty good, and I love the people. So to me, the people here are marvelous, and it's refreshing. I can wake up in the morning knowing that I'm in a country that's not bombing anybody, that doesn't have special operations forces in 150 countries bashing down doors. They're focusing on trying to improve their own people in this country of 6.2 million people. So I'm hoping to start a Veterans for Peace chapter here. I've already started that process. I'm hoping to have a project to raise money for the amputee hospital here, Aldo Chavarria. That really needs better supplies. I'm really just interested in helping out however I can in my later years here. I'm a member of Organization of Revolutionary Disabled, which whatever they need, I'm prepared to help out, raise money, or go speak on their behalf. It's an experiment. I mean, when I came here in July and had a party when I left, my going away party, and I said, am I crazy? I've just turned 76 and I'm going to go live in Nicaragua. What's wrong with me? Tell me. Well, almost everybody said, go for it. So here I am.
Yeah.
It's an experiment, but it's something that I'm really into it.
Let's end with one last question. 10 years down the road, what will make you happiest to have accomplished with these projects? What would you like to see happening as a result of your efforts?
You mentioned about preserving memory. I want the Nicaraguans to preserve memory as well as U.S. people. Often traumatic events, it's tempting to forget about it because it's painful. But I think it's revolutionary to remember what those early ideas were in a revolution. I just hope that I will have been able to help some people, some disabled people from the war, that we caused those disabilities. We created the pain and suffering, and that perhaps I can enjoy being an elder in Nicaragua and receive lots of guests and visitors from the United States. Have the center, Casa Sandino. I just want to be a good global citizen living in a country where my country has caused so much damage, and doing a little bit of atonement work as a U.S. person who's now a citizen, but want to practice solidarity with the people that we hurt. And I learn from them all the time.
I'm sure lots of people in Portland and others listening to KBOO will want to help out in a few months. Probably there'll be a website and Facebook page for Casa Sandino. And if not, you can find Brian Wilson online quite easily from various other projects
that he's
doing
also.
On Facebook as well. So S. Brian Wilson with two L's in it. So thank you so much. This has been Todd Sloan for KBOO Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Brian Wilson in Granada, Nicaragua.
Thank you.
Adios.
Adios.
Tronaron los atabales, premolaron las marimbas, todos los alcaravanes repitieron la consigna, empuñando la bandera rojinegra sandinista. Camilo Ortega Saavedra hacia la aurora marchó. Tu sangre pura, Camilo, va creciendo en las pitayas, en la risa de los niños de mi amada Nicaragua. Tu sangre pura, Camilo, llamarada en la montaña, derramó sobre mi patria su violenta floración. Vivirás, Morimbo, llama pura del pueblo, oigo tu corazón. Atabal guerrillero, donde el indio cayó, floreció el granadillo para hacer la marimba que toca los sones de liberación.
And that's Nicaraguan musician and songwriter Carlos Mejia Godoy, one of the founders of Nueva Canción, or New Song, the politically conscious music that accompanied liberation struggles throughout Latin America in the 70s and beyond. And just before that, we heard Todd Sloan's interview in Nicaragua with activist Brian Wilson. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO in Portland. I'm Clayton Morgridge. And in a few minutes, I'll have some commentary about capitalism, consumerism, and mental health. Right now, though, the baseball fan and Old Mole Denise Morris has these thoughts about who threw out the first pitch at the National League playoff game the other night.
Sports journalist, author, and dedicated lefty Dave Zirin has spent his career debunking the idea that sports and politics don't mix. His first book, What's My Name Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States, published in 2005, was the beginning of a long career dedicated to exposing the myths and inequities that govern professional sports. It also exposed the truth that professional athletes have always stood for something and have often ignored the shouts to, quote, shut up and play. Again, professional athletes are pushing the buttons of billionaire owners, politicians, and pundits, with recent on-field protests sparked last year by then-49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick. Protests intended to call attention to police violence and racism spread throughout the NFL, culminating in this year's opening weekend, where players and coaches acted in solidarity by taking a knee during the playing of the national anthem. Since Kaepernick's protests began last year, the debates in the media over nationalism and militarism in sports has exploded, many exposing the deep roots in sport, but also the myth that it has always been this way. Quote, in America, the game doesn't start until the national anthem plays. It's not a mandate, it's just a fact, as culturally ingrained as team colors and touchdown cheers. The tradition runs deep, and it's easy to forget it wasn't always this way. After World War II, the commissioner of the NFL at the time, Elmer Leyden, made a specific plea to keep the anthem as a game day tradition. The playing of the national anthem should be as much a part of every game as the kickoff, he said. We must not drop it simply because the war is over. We should never forget what it stands for. While the anthem continued to be a game day fixture, NFL players typically stayed in the locker room for it, but it wasn't until 2009 that players were mandated to be on the field for the song. That's from A.J. Willingham writing for CNN. Writing last summer in the Washington Post, columnist Kevin Blackstone looked back at the 1968 Olympics for some insight into the sacred marriage of nationalism in sport. Quote, all anyone wanted to talk about that night at the Mexico City Summer Games in 1968 was that Tommy Smith and John Carlos, black U.S. Olympic medal winning sprinters, didn't stand properly. With heads held high and hands over heart for a rendition of the national anthem. Instead, they punctuated the dark sky with black gloved fists and lowered their heads in shame for what roiled in America's belly. Police brutality against people of color who were responding to it with rebellion. What Smith and Carlos did was exercise the audacity to disrupt a sporting event, which we have been conditioned to believe is a societal safe space, a theater of escape, a spectacle sanitized of any of our ills. Nearly half a century later, with the kickoff of this football season, San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick reminded us of how absurdly we still regard sporting events and their nationalistic rituals. He sat during three playings of the national anthem. He kneeled for another. He did so, he explained effusively, because he felt uncomfortable honoring the symbol of a country that oppresses black people and people of color. And just like in 1968, it wasn't Kaepernick's message that drew so much reaction. It was his method for dissemination. For he dared to protest in the athletic arena, where we wrap sporting events in a prophylactic of patriotism used to demand political conformity and suppress discourse. For modern-day athletes of color like Smith, Carlos, and Kaepernick, and others historically marginalized by society, like women and religious minorities, sport is not just fun and games. It is so much more. We were reminded of that in the early 60s when Muhammad Ali reversed the self-emasculation in particular that the black athlete had agreed to in the 1930s and 40s, and are oddly celebrated as national heroes for doing so, simply to participate. For those often disenfranchised in society, our games are the most visible space, an exalted space, a space from which most cannot turn away to voice concern. They create a space in which those who feel that they are not being heard can be heard loud and clear. Again, that's Washington Post columnist Kevin Blackstone. As a socialist and a sports fan, I find all this debate, reflection, and action very exciting. Politics is in the fabric of everything for me, so I responded with nothing but horror and disgust when I heard Louisiana Congressman Steve Scalise was invited to throw out the first pitch at the Washington Nationals versus Chicago Cubs opening playoff game last Friday night, October 6th. From Dan Steinberg, also writing in the Washington Post, quote, House Majority Whip Steve Scalise, Republican, Louisiana, who was shot and seriously wounded at a practice for the annual congressional baseball game in June, threw out the first pitch at Friday night's Nationals-Cubs playoff game. Baseball is not known for having many rock-the-boat outspoken athletes. There are some, but to date, only one player joined NFL players in solidarity by taking a knee during the anthem. So in spite of my horror, I am not surprised that the Nationals ownership, Lerner Enterprises, would invite Scalise. After all, if you are a billionaire, Steve is on your side. Lerner is the team owner, but D.C. taxpayers paid for the stadium to be built to the tune of more than $600 million. In spite of the very warm on-field reception, many Nationals fans and D.C. citizens voiced their displeasure with the choice, given that Scalise is an extreme conservative and just prior to his invite confirmed that his experience being shot only solidified his conviction that gun control laws are bad. This on the heels of the tragic mass shooting in Las Vegas. And to top it off, Scalise, whose life was saved by an out lesbian officer, picked up where he left off by agreeing to address the Family Research Council's Values Voter Summit on October 13th in Washington, D.C. The FRC is an anti-abortion, anti-gay, conservative group and lobbying organization. Along with nationalism, heroes go with sports like mom and apple pie. I am a fan who wants to do away with heroes. Maybe not forever, but for now, in these times, when a man like Steve Scalise, who will use traditional family values to obscure his anti-worker, anti-immigrant, pro-billionaire, can be a hero. He is, in fact, a symbol of all that is crushing us fans, our friends, and our families. His biggest financial contributors are not the Family Research Council or the NRA. It's oil and gas, real estate, insurance, and health professionals. And come on, Major League Baseball players, he hates unions. I do have one thing in common with Steve Scalise. We both turned 52 this year. This has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
We like our beer flat as candy. We like our dogs with mustard and relish. We got a great picture, what's his name?
And that's Cheap Seats by the band Alabama, following Denise Morris's commentary about baseball, nationalism, and racism. Right now we're going to turn to my commentary about how capitalism distorts our lives and our souls. President Trump last week called Stephen Paddock, the Las Vegas shooter, a sick man, a demented man, adding that we are dealing with a very, very sick individual. Doubtless there was something drastically wrong in Stephen Paddock's life that led him to act as he did. But can we separate that individual life from the way our common life is organized? Rather, as changes in the global climate have to be factored into what gives rise to the recent hurricanes, so our evolving economic and political climate has to be seen as background conditions for what people do. But just as climate change does not give us a complete explanation of, for example, Hurricane Maria, neither does our social system completely explain what an individual like Stephen Paddock did. In fact, we do not have enough information about his life to even begin to speculate about his motives. But whatever they were planted and cultivated in the soil of capitalist society and culture. A recent article in the UK magazine Red Pepper by Rob Tweedy makes the claim that capitalism is a mental illness-generating system. In the U.S., according to the Atlantic Monthly, over a 12-month period, 27% of adults in the U.S. will experience some kind of mental health disorder. And, of course, that doesn't take account of the many that go unreported. Tweedy cites similar figures for the U.K. and asks, what if it's not we who are sick, but a system at odds with who we are as human beings. Tweedy, drawing on a number of psychologists, argues in effect that capitalism makes us crazy. Again, that is not to say capitalism is the sole or even the main cause of an extreme case like Paddock, but it does suggest that there is a great deal of misery that can be attributed to capitalism. Here's why. First, capitalist ideology assumes that commodity civilization promotes happiness. The way we live revolves around getting and spending money on commodities that are sold on the basis that every desire can be fulfilled by buying, possessing, and constantly upgrading the right products and services. Our real desires have been hijacked to be replaced by an insatiable craving, the lust for commodities, and of course for money, the commodity that is the key to all commodities. This vitiation of the human soul is the underlying source of our epidemic levels of mental illness, suicide, violence, depression, substance abuse, and barely tolerable levels of bad behavior and misery. Stephen Paddock's brother Eric was assuming this axiom of consumer society when he expressed astonishment at Stephen's crime. After all, Eric said, Stephen was a wealthy guy. He liked to play video poker, and he liked to go on cruises. In other words, money and what it buys should make you happy. The desire for money and what money can buy is a self-centered, individualistic desire. The real desire that is smothered under the flood of commodity culture is the fundamental desire to be in solidarity with others. We need to be recognized and loved by others for who we are, not for what we have. And we want to recognize and love others through caring and cooperative activity. These desires are overwhelmed by the need in capitalist society to compete with others for position and wealth. Of course, for most of us, getting the money we need to live requires working for wages on terms set by the owners and managers of capital. To survive, we have little choice but to allow ourselves to be enslaved to the agenda of capital accumulation, doing work that mostly makes no positive contribution to human welfare, and that often does serious damage to us and to the planet. The dominant economic agents in modern capitalist society are corporations, and as Joel Bacon has pointed out in his book, The Corporation, the corporation is, by definition, a pathological institution. Its legally defined mandate is to pursue relentlessly and without exception its own self-interest, regardless of the often harmful consequences it might cause to others. The diagnostic features of its default pathology are lack of empathy, pursuit of self-interest, grandiosity, shallow affect, aggression, and social indifference, unquote. The courts have determined that a corporation is a person. If so, then despite what their PR and advertisements say, they're nasty persons with long criminal records. Moreover, and going beyond Tweedy's piece, the implementation of neoliberalism over the past 30 years or so has eviscerated the comforting thought that at least the state, especially the federal government, had our backs. Those who control government today make it clear that they would like to see every public good or service turned over to profit-seeking corporations. Their agenda of tax breaks for big corporations and wealthy individuals makes the rich richer, but does nothing for the rest of us. Because, as I argued in my commentary last month, very little of that extra money gets invested in job-creating enterprises, but is instead put into stocks and bonds and other shadier financial gimmicks. Now, of course, Stephen Paddock was not part of the working class being hurt by neoliberalism. But like all of us, he was part of the pathological world that capitalism has created, a world in which human life and human activity is valued first and foremost in terms of its market value, and in which no one is really expected to act except out of self-interest. Obviously, Paddock's success in this system, his accumulation of enough money that he could spend his life traveling and gambling, could not make up for whatever damage had been done to his soul that he was trying to express or avenge. I hope it is clear that I am not expressing sympathy for Paddock, much less trying to excuse or justify what he did. It is only natural that we should want to focus our blame on specific people, either the individual with evil in his heart, or the politicians and gun manufacturers who make it possible for one man to command so much massacre-ready weaponry. But we need to look beyond the actions and motives of individuals. For as long as we allow the world to be governed in the interests of maximizing the wealth of an already wealthy elite and subordinating all values to money values, pathological behavior of many kinds will continue. A better world is possible, one organized for the cooperation of us all towards meeting the needs of all. In fact, that better world is not only possible, but imperative. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Come by me.
And that's Paul McCartney live with the Beatles in 1964. Winding up the Old Mole Variety Hour, many thanks to Bill Resnick and Margot Black for their analysis of the housing crisis, to Todd Sloan for sending in his interview from Nicaragua with Brian Wilson, and to Denise Morris for her discussion of politics and baseball. And as always, we are grateful to Patsy Kullberg for her smooth handling of some of our crises that occur during this show and the way she handles the knobs and buttons on the operating board. Remember that you can hear the show again by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Tell your friends about pieces you think they should hear. Today's show will be up in a day or two, and join us again next Monday at 9 for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective.